Lloyd Morvette, and Peter Bergil. Thank you, all of you, for joining us tonight for KBOO News In Depth.
Thank you, Emma.
Thank you, Emma.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you, KBOO.
Greetings, I'm Ansa Krigland.
And I'm Winston Watson.
And I'm Donald Clark.
And we are The Meditation.
We are listening to Community Radio.
KBOO
90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. Dig it.
Tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Now this coming Thursday on Words and Pictures, we're talking Democracy Under Siege with filmmaker Laura Nix and political cartoonist Ann Telness. Ann Telness recently quit her job at the Washington Post after her cartoon showing billionaires bowing down to Trump was spiked by the paper. She's the star of a new documentary by Laura Nix, the filmmaker behind The Yes Men Are Revolting. So tune in for a special hour-long Words and Pictures this Thursday, February 13th, from 11 a.m. till noon on your community radio station, KBOO.
I'm out to sing songs that'll prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom and not
those of us who have been working in this space for a long time, we had an idea that we would get some sort of a massive assault on riots. And I actually, in the immediate aftermath of the election, for those of you who do read my newsletter, the very next day I published a, here are the steps that you need to take right now. I think that this is an issue of exhaustion. That is part of why we have seen this blitz of executive orders. It's designed to scare. It's designed to make you feel exhausted. It's designed to make you feel powerless.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Australia reviews gender-affirming healthcare for kids, Donald Trump attacks trans medical and military rights, and journalist Aaron Reed dissects Trump's executive order blitz. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Joe Bainline.
With NewsWrap,
a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 1st, 2025. Gender-affirming healthcare for Australia's trans and gender-diverse young people is under review. The National Health and Medical Research Council will conduct the study, which will include the efficacy of hormone treatments and puberty blockers. Queensland's January 29th announcement of its own review moved the federal government to take action 2 days later. The state plans to pause access to all gender-affirming healthcare for new patients under the age of 18. Australian Health Minister Mark Butler urged Queensland officials to yield to the federal review and allow treatment to continue for the state's current young trans patients pending those results. He wants treatment guidelines to be nationally consistent. Butler says the committee of experts conducting the review will look at treatment guidelines in other countries. It will include public consultation and, importantly, the lived experiences of young trans and gender diverse patients. An interim report on the specific use of puberty blockers for young people with gender dysphoria is expected by the middle of 2026. There are no time projections for reports regarding other forms of pediatric gender affirming care. The antagonistic grassroots Australian Christian lobby is urging the government to ensure that the review is truly independent, free from activist influence, and grounded in medical evidence, not ideology. Meanwhile, most LGBTQ advocacy groups are cautiously optimistic about the national review. Equality Australia vows its participation in the process and urges Queensland officials to abandon their temporary pause so pediatric gender-affirming care continues to be delivered to patients across the country. CEO Anna Brown said, "Politicians should not be in the business of making medical decisions for young people and families they have never met and whose experience of life are unimaginable to most of them." Transcend Australia CEO Jeremy Wiggins expressed the fears of parents in his organization about the review, but hopes if this federal process remains ethical, draws on evidence, and the right people, including those with lived experience, we are confident the outcome will be positive for trans children and young people.
U.S. President Donald Trump has blood on his hands, in the words of Advocates for Trans Equality Executive Director Rodrigo Heng Leitinen. Trump's latest and perhaps most egregious anti-transgender executive order restricts gender-affirming health care for people under the age of 19. Heng Leitinen warns this executive order not only prohibits, but sets the stage for criminalizing medically necessary gender-affirming care, endangering tens of thousands of transgender adolescents. The fallacy-ridden screed reads in part, "It is the policy of the United States that it will not fund, sponsor, promote, assist, or support the so-called transition of a child from one sex to another, and it will rigorously enforce all laws that prohibit or limit these destructive and life-altering procedures." The ban includes hormone therapies and puberty blockers, both of which are reversible. It prohibits pediatric gender-affirming surgery, which is rarely a recommended treatment option. The order halts funding through federally run insurance programs such as Medicaid and the military families TRICARE. LGBTQ policy analysts from the Williams Institute at UCLA issued a brief saying that Trump's order requires further administrative rulemaking, therefore it will not take effect immediately. Like many of Trump's shock and awe flurry of edicts, the legality of his ban on gender-affirming care for young people will almost certainly be challenged in court.
One Trump executive order is already on its way to court. The Human Rights Campaign and Lambda Legal are taking on the new ban on service in the U.S. military by transgender and gender-diverse enlistees. The same two national queer rights groups successfully blocked the first Trump administration's attempted military service ban in the 2017 Karnofsky v. Trump case. Trump reversed a Biden administration order that had opened service to qualified trans people, then specifically excluded them with another. It affects new recruits, but it could also impact currently serving trans and gender diverse personnel. In the words of Lambda Legal Counsel Sasha Burkett, thousands of current service members are transgender, and many have been serving openly, courageously, and successfully in the U.S. military for more than 8 years. HRC Vice President of Legal Sarah Warbelow says the order insults their service and puts our national security at risk.
The United States Supreme Court has agreed to hear tales of a family attending an LGBTQ pride event, a girl meeting her uncle's husband-to-be, and a prince's love for a night as they battle a dragon together. A group of parents in Montgomery County, Maryland, want the right to pull their children from elementary school classes that include such storybooks. They claim that their religious beliefs are being violated if they cannot shield their kids from LGBTQ content. They've already lost in an appeals court. Lawyers for the Washington, D.C. suburb school system had asked the high court to reject the case. They argued that the storybooks being challenged touch on themes of adventure, confronting new emotions, and making oneself heard, just like the classics Snow White, Cinderella, and Peter Pan. The district wrote, "Parents who chose to send their children to public schools are not deprived of their right to freely exercise their religion simply because their children are exposed to curricular material the parents find offensive." The parents are being represented by Eric Baxter, senior counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. He insists that the school district is cramming down controversial gender ideology on three-year-olds. It's unclear if the Supreme Court will hear arguments in the case before its new term begins in October, according to the Associated Press.
Minneapolis, Minnesota's Twin Cities Pride is parting ways with one of its biggest business sponsors, but it certainly won't be sorry. The organization broke up with Target Stores in response to the Minneapolis-based Giant Retailer's announcement that it would end or scale back programs that promote diversity in the workforce and corporate culture. While it has scored high marks for inclusivity in the past, it's now ending its participation in the Human Rights Campaign's annual Corporate Equality Index. Far-right social media zealot Robbie Starbuck was targeting Target for potential consumer boycotts against corporate DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. More than a dozen major companies have bowed to those threats. Executive Director Andy Otto told the Minnesota Star Tribune that Twin Cities Pride would reject Target's expected $50,000 to $70,000 sponsorship this year to protest the company's surrender. As he told the Star Tribune, "Unfortunately, in a time when it's been a really, really rough week for our community, given everything that has come down from the new Trump administration, this was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back." That proud gesture did not go unrewarded. Donations from the community made up for the Target sponsorship in less than 24 hours and doubled it within a few days.
Finally, the day before rival Target stores joined the trend of corporations abandoning DEI programs, voters representing 98% of Costco shareholders rejected a bid to dump its inclusivity initiatives. The defeated proposal was sponsored by the Robbie Starbuck Allied National Center for Public Policy Research. Costco's board of directors had vigorously defended the company's DEI policies, proud to proclaim that inclusion is central to their successful business model. The consulting firm Global Data predicted the vote ahead of the stockholders' meeting. Its retail division managing director Neil Saunders said, "I think people generally have confidence in Costco's management, and there's an attitude of, why rock the boat? It's sailing very nicely." Costco CEO Ron Vacris praised the overwhelming support of our shareholders. Starbuck lamented the vote in a social media post, saying that, "For now, I suggest conservative consumers find other places to spend their money." He probably shops at Target.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 1st, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry. Stay healthy.
And I'm Joe Bainline. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Look what they done to my song, Ma. Half right, it's turning out all wrong, Ma. Look what they done to my song.
There's a target on the back of every transgender person in the U.S., and the public policy weapons are in the hands of the MAGA Republicans. The war is personal for transgender journalist Erin Reed. She's a respected independent voice with a large following on social media, earning more than 250 million views in recent years. Reed met last week with a group of trans people and allies to review the growing list of anti-trans executive orders coming out of the Trump White House. This Way Out's David Hunt covered the correspondence conversation.
First came a presidential order defining gender in the simplest terms.
It made it the official policy of the United States government that there are only two genders, male and female. Gee, that was a tough one.
That executive order, signed on Inauguration Day by President Donald Trump, was quickly followed by two more assailing the rights of transgender Americans. One lays the groundwork for banning transgender people from serving in the United States military. The other attempts to outlaw gender-affirming health care for young people nationwide. These, among hundreds of executive orders of debatable constitutionality, came in rapid-fire succession, leaving reporters scrambling to cover the story, to predict the impact of the measures, and, as always with Trump, to separate fact from fiction. I'm David Hunt. In the news business, when a reporter dominates coverage of an issue or event, tapping the best sources and providing the most insightful analysis, we say they own the story. If anyone owns the story of the rights assault on transgender Americans, it's Erin Reed.
I don't think many of us asked to be on the vanguard of this, but here we are. We're here. And we are building a world where future generations, I hope to God, don't have to fight this same fight. And as much as all the sound and fury from the top of the Oval Office is sort of raining down upon us, there are more people like me than ever before that are public, that are themselves.
Reed isn't just one of a small group of queer journalists covering national politics. She's one of an even smaller subset of transgender journalists. As such, she's covering the political assault on her own rights, even her own existence, and providing that coverage in great detail and with great accuracy, employing a veteran reporter's unflinching scrutiny. In a line-by-line analysis of Trump's order banning trans people in the military, she wrote, "This marks a chilling and undeniable shift. The attacks on transgender people are no longer cloaked in the faux respectability of evidence, science, or protecting kids. They never truly were, but now even the pretense has been abandoned." Her daily reporting can be read on Substack, a subscription-based platform for independent journalists. Find her at erininthemorning.com, with Erin spelled E-R-I-N. On January 30th, Reed met with about 100 trans people and their allies on a Zoom call sponsored by the trans-led nonprofit GRACE, Gender Research Advisory Council and Education. What started as a review of anti-trans legislation soon turned into a strategy session and pep talk with Grace board member Kathy Brennan.
Okay, Aaron, can you unmute yourself?
Yes, hello. Hi, everybody. How's it going?
Yeah, here you are.
I wished it were better circumstances, but I'm here tonight to speak with all of you. And look forward to talking. You know, I've been doing this work for a long time, and I think that there are very few people who have the history that I do in terms of like reading the stuff at the beginning. I was there whenever all of this current wave started. You know, whenever you talk about 5 years ago, if you would time travel somebody from 5 years ago to today, it would be unrecognizable. The debate over transgender people and our care and our existence and more. If all of you will probably remember 5 years ago, the biggest thing back then around trans people were a smattering of states that had sports bans, and that was it. There was one bathroom ban in 2016 in North Carolina, and that was a disaster. The PayPal pulled out of the state. Deutsche Bank pulled out of the state. They lost $3.7 billion in revenue because of that bathroom ban. But what happened after that was the same organizations that have become very popular, famous now, infamous now, you know, your Alliance Defending Freedom, your Project 2025, groups like the Heritage Foundation and more, they held a conference in 2017 in Phoenix, Arizona, and they planned out their strategy for what we're seeing now. And they executed that strategy over time. They, one of the architects of the plan from the American Principles Project, Terry Schilling, had specifically said that they were going to start with sports so that way they could get people comfortable with discriminating. And then after they got you with sports, they were going to go to kids, and then they were going to go to bathrooms, and then they were going to continue growing on that more and more and more. And like he sort of James Bond monologued this to CNN in early 2020. And we're seeing exactly that. Like the strategy has happened exactly as he had planned it. And the same groups that, you know, were part of that conference are now the ones that are writing the Trump executive order.
So where do we start now, right? Like it's, you know, it's kind of a really tough situation, but now we have all these executive orders. So the first one being about the military, and then about government ID. So access, you know, government ID, your ID is your access to everything in this country and the world, you know, like your driver's license, your social security card, your, all of it. Like, so it's, you know, access. And if you don't have access, you don't have anything else.
Those of us who have been working in this space for a long time, we had an idea that we would get some sort of a blitz, some sort of a massive assault on rights. And I actually, in the immediate aftermath of the election, for those of you who do read my newsletter, the very next day I published a, here are the steps that you need to take right now. And at the very top of that list was go get your passport renewed right now. Get it renewed right now. And thankfully, I was able to reach a large number of the community. I had built up quite a large readership, a large following, large viewership on various social media video platforms like TikTok and Instagram, where I blasted this message out there because I knew that one of the first dominoes to fall would be passports. And in fact, the very first day of the Trump presidency, we got an executive order that erased legal recognition of transgender people throughout the government. So in every single aspect of the way that the executive branch handles trans people. So we're talking non-discrimination protections. Are they going to, for instance, file a claim of non-discrimination if I get denied housing, you know, because I'm trans, because a particular landlord doesn't like that, doesn't want a trans person moving into the neighborhood? Am I going to be discriminated against in education because, you know, a public university decides that trans people go against their mission? And you know, typically, no, you're not supposed to be able to discriminate against people like that. But this administration has stated that it will refuse that legal recognition. And the top of that, the most impactful of that, was in passports, because many people that were in the process of getting their passports have had them held up right now.
You are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt. Much of Aaron Reed's work as a journalist focuses on providing context to the onslaught of anti-trans measures flooding the zone with shit, in the words of Trump strategist Steve Bannon. She said the culture war attacks don't represent the lived experiences of many trans and LGBTQ people.
With all of the bad laws and all of the harmful things that they're doing at that level on our legal documents and more, on a personal level, I've never felt more support in my entire life. Like, I've got more support than I ever have. I myself in public every single day. I never get a second look. People talk to me about, you know, the things that I care about. I am a productive member of society. I am here. I have friends. And I think that part of the reason why they're making such a push through laws is because they know that the people that you live with in your community, that hate is not there. It's not, they want you to believe that it's so much more present. I think that this is an issue of exhaustion. And I think that that is part of why we have seen this blitz of executive orders. It's designed to scare. It's designed to make you feel exhausted. It's designed to make you feel powerless.
In a news analysis on her site, Reed explained how Trump's executive order defining gender could fundamentally reshape how laws, policies, and regulations are applied throughout federal agencies. The practical implications are enormous, she wrote. These definitions form the foundation of the rest of the executive orders, serving as a directive for every federal agency to reinterpret and enforce their policies through this narrow and reductive lens. For instance, the Department of Education could use this definition to exclude transgender women from Title IX protections, federal protections from sex discrimination enacted in 1972. In an analysis of the executive order banning gender-affirming care, Reed said the measure explicitly weaponizes the Department of Justice against transgender youth, their families, and their medical providers. The order defines gender-affirming care as mutilation, and then exploits that definition to claim that female genital mutilation laws apply to transgender care. The executive order wields every available lever of power, and even some Trump may not legally control, Reed reported. If there's such a thing as a trans power couple, it's Reed and her wife, Zoe Zephyr, the first trans woman elected to the Montana legislature. The couple tied the knot last December in a ceremony at the Missoula County Fairgrounds in Montana. A moment that was, in Reed's words, perfect in every way.
I saw fireworks that day. Freeway, I saw fireworks for the second time in 2 days.
In April 2023, Zephyr was barred from her seat on the floor of the Montana House of Representatives after she shamed the Republican majority for voting to outlaw gender-affirming care for young people. She spent the remainder of the legislative session working from a bench in the House lobby, a bench her supporters took turns occupying on her behalf after Republicans tried to deny her even that place to sit down. The GOP's petty tactics may have alienated some of their supporters, Reed explained.
You know, we drove to Glacier National Park, beautiful national park, and we pulled up to the side, and then this big F-250 pulled up behind us. And out came three burly men in camo. They walked up to us, and one of them looked to her and said, "Are you Zoe Zephyr?" And Zoe's like, yeah, that's me. Hi.
Wow.
And he said, "Well, I'm a Republican." It's like, we can guess, but that's okay. I'm a Republican. But then he said, "But I want to let you know I would sit on that seat for you." And he just... he had such a visceral response to the idea that, like, she's a democratically elected person who is being silenced just for speaking words, just for saying her mind.
Reed advised the trans people and their supporters on the Zoom call to focus on the things they can accomplish, the connections they can make, even in difficult times.
Don't let yourself burn out. Have something that has an endpoint. Find your local community. That's how we got through Stonewall. I mean, that's how we got through that period, is that we had our gay straight alliances and our queer family groups, our church groups, and more. And I think that, you know, whatever that looks like for you, help foster those connections, because that will help people stay here while we're dealing with all this.
I'd like to thank GRACE Executive Director Elena Kupek, Board Member Kathy Brennan, and journalist Aaron Reed for organizing this discussion of the assault on transgender rights by the Trump administration. Find links to their websites at thiswayout.org. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
To the river we go, leave our worries on the shore and drift away. On the river we know, sometimes the perfect words are never said.
Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Tanya Kane Perry and Joe Bainline, and produced by Brian DeShazer. David Hunt produced this week's Aaron Reed feature, with thanks to Kathy Brennan and GRACE, Gender Research Advisory Council and Education. The Beatles, Melanie Safka, and Michael Shines performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Lee Sloan of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappelle, and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening. Online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, on CFMH St. John, New Brunswick, KYAQ Newport, Lincoln County, Oregon, WORT Madison, Wisconsin, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay safe, stay healthy, and stay tuned.
K-Boo.
The LA Times called Mekla a network of political clout that is based on converting money and influence into political power rather than electing gays to political office.
Full political and civil equality for gay and lesbian Americans has not yet been achieved, that gay and lesbian Americans are treated as second-class citizens. Democracy can only flourish when all Americans can affirm themselves as citizens by full participation in our political process.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Trump bans trans girls and women from women's school sports. Trans rights get Grammy-winning shoutouts, and gay Pac-Men score major wins in 80s U.S. politics. Those stories and more this week, because you found This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Ava Davis.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 8th, 2025.
With this executive order, the war on women's sports is over. So this will effectively end the attack on female athletes at public K-12 schools and virtually all U.S. colleges and universities.
U.S. President Donald Trump is banning trans girls and women from competing in female sports at federally funded schools and universities. It's the latest blistering executive order targeting transgender people. Trump rambled on in a 30-minute February 5th pre-signing speech, littered with several lies and inflammatory claims. He falsely claimed that trans athletes had won more than 3,500 victories and invaded more than 11,000 competitions. He perpetuated the lie that men are beating up, injuring, and cheating our women and our girls. The order is officially titled No Men in Women's Sports, and it was the president's so-called celebration of National Girls and Women in Sports Day. The ceremonial photo op featured dozens of girls and young women surrounding the adjudicated rapist as he signed the order. Executive orders are not law, but they are specific directives issued by the president to all federal agencies. Every one of Trump's anti-queer executive orders will almost certainly be challenged in court.
The impact of the No Men in Women's Sports executive order is already being felt, however. Within hours of Trump's signing it, the National Collegiate Athletic Association announced that it would comply. NCAA President Charlie Baker said in a press statement, "We strongly believe that clear, consistent, and uniform eligibility standards would best serve today's student athletes instead of a patchwork of conflicting state laws and court decisions. To that end, President Trump's order provides a clear national standard." Baker recently testified before a U.S. Senate panel that fewer than 10 transgender athletes among some 510,000 competitors currently participate in NCAA sports. The move prompted one member of the NCAA's Committee on Competitive Safeguards and Medical Aspects of Sports to resign. Dr. Jack Turbin told Baker in an open letter that the decision to bow to Trump does not align with medical or scientific consensus. I cannot, in good conscience, participate in this kind of politicization of science and medicine at the expense of some of our most vulnerable student athletes.
All references to transgender people are disappearing from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website. Further fallout from Trump's executive orders that all federal agencies stop promoting gender ideology. Trans-specific information about HIV testing is gone. In fact, most educational HIV/AIDS information has vanished from the site. A banner explaining that the CDC website is being modified to comply with President Trump's executive orders is now displayed. The critical order is called Defending Women from Gender Ideology Extremism and Restoring Biological Truth to the Federal Government. It restricts the definition of gender to the binary male or female. Researchers at the nation's Atlanta, Georgia-based CDC have also been instructed to cleanse a list of specific phrases from their work product before any publication. Gender, transgender, pregnant person, pregnant people, LGBT, transsexual, non-binary, assigned male at birth, assigned female at birth, and biologically male, biologically female. In the words of GLAAD's Sarah Kate Ellis, Trump is clearly committed to censorship of any information containing or related to LGBTQ Americans and issues that we face. The queer advocacy group's president said that his pathetic attempt to diminish and remove us will again prove unsuccessful.
It's even come down to the email signatures of federal employees. Following the slew of presidential executive orders targeting transgender people, the Trump regime has ordered all federal employees to remove the pronouns from their email signatures. It's also part of the plan to restrict or eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and policies from every federal government agency. Employees are being warned that violating Trump's executive orders could result in possible disciplinary action, including termination. The pronouns ban was just the beginning. Agencies are now being ordered to review and remove all references to gender identity in programs, contracts, and grants. Trans workers can no longer use restrooms in federal facilities that match their gender identities. Democratic U.S. Representative from Delaware, Sarah McBride, is loudly condemning Trump's anti-trans attacks. She's Congress's first and only out transgender member. In her words, "From day one, the administration has taken actions that would force the outing of transgender people, stripping them of their privacy and safety. Each time the Trump administration attacks a small, vulnerable community, the ripple effects of hate echo across our society."
The first queer legal strikeback against the Trump administration's anti-LGBTQ onslaught is going to court. It's a lawsuit challenging the executive order ban on gender-affirming health care for patients younger than 19, brought by the LGBTQ advocacy group Lambda Legal the National American Civil Liberties Union, and the ACLU of Maryland. Seven families with transgender or non-binary children are the plaintiffs, joined by PFLAG National, an organization for families and friends of LGBTQ people. They went to the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland on February 4th to ask for a preliminary and permanent injunction to stop the ban from going into effect. The lawsuit argues that Trump's anti-trans executive orders are unlawful and unconstitutional because they seek to withhold federal funds previously authorized by Congress. They also charge that the orders violate federal anti-discrimination laws. It's the first, but no doubt not the last, courtroom battlefront in the war between the incoming U.S. administration and the LGBTQ plus community. The fight has been joined.
Finally, many are calling the 67th annual Grammy Awards the queerest ever. Quite a few openly LGBTQ performers and several outspoken allies took home trophies in Los Angeles on February 2nd. And they were not quiet at the music industry's biggest celebration. Lesbian rapper and actor Queen Latifah presented veteran hitmaker Alicia Keys with a Dr. Dre Global Impact Award. Keys celebrated often unsung female producers and poked the orange elephant in the room over diversity, equity, and inclusion.
This is not the time to shut down the diversity of voices. We've seen on this stage talented, hardworking people from different backgrounds with different points of view, and it changes the game. DEI is not a threat, it's a gift.
Lesbian singer Chappelle Roan performed her chart-topping Pink Pony Club during the telecast and then won the Best New Artist Grammy. She stressed trans rights during a red carpet interview ahead of the ceremonies.
Brutal right now, but trans people have always existed and they will forever exist, and they will never, no matter what happens, take trans joy away, and that has to be protected more than anything, because I would not be here without trans girls. So just know that pop music is thinking about you and cares about you, and I'm trying my best to like really stand up for you.
Longtime ally, Lady Gaga, won the Grammy for Best Pop Duo Group Performance for Die With a Smile, which she sang with Bruno Mars. Gaga used her platform to take a strong stand for the embattled transgender and queer communities.
It is a privilege to be a songwriter and a producer, a musician. It's such an honor to sing for all of you. And I just want to say tonight that trans people are not invisible. Trans people deserve love. The queer community deserves to be lifted up. Music is love. Thank you.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 8th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazor, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V. Stay healthy.
And I'm Ava Davis. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Demonizing LGBTQ people for political gain is nothing new. The first major confrontation between queer and conservative powerhouses in the U.S. was four decades ago. The aggressive culture war launched by pop singer Anita Bryant and televangelist Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority. there are lessons in strategy to learn from those difficult days. In addition to the street activism of the 70s, checkbook activism became a thing, and the country's first official LGBTQ political action committee was born. This Way Out's David Hunt tells the story of that organization's rise to prominence.
You've probably never heard of MECLA, the Municipal Elections Committee of Los Angeles. But in its heyday, in the 1980s, it was a political powerhouse, raising large sums of money and using it to reward local, state, and national politicians whose interests aligned, at least some of the time, with its own. MECLA was a special interest, the first political action committee organized to advance the cause of gays and lesbians in the United States. This at a time when gays were largely closeted, and for good reason. Legally, they were outlaws, socially outcasts, and politically outmatched and outspent by the New Right, a broad coalition of Christian fundamentalists and social conservatives. With the rise of MECLA, gays and lesbians wielded a new tool in the fight for equality, what a California politician once called the mother's milk of politics, money. Join me now for a deep dive into the rise and fall of MECLA, a queer story of power politics in the Reagan era. I'm David Hunt. It's April 23rd, 1983. David Bowie's Let's Dance is moving up the music charts in the United States, and that's exactly what the crowd at the Hollywood Palladium has on its mind this evening. They've turned out in black tie, tuxes, and designer gowns, and shelled out $175 apiece to drink, dine, and dance in the Palladium's Art Deco ballroom. But before they can show off their moves on the dance floor, attendees turn their attention to the guest of honor, who just happens to be a leading candidate for president.
Now, I may be naive, but I believe any candidate for the presidency should welcome the opportunity to speak to any group of Americans who believe in the first principles of this country: equality and justice, freedom of speech and freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, and freedom of expression.
Gary Hart, a U.S. Senator from Colorado, is anything but naive. He's an Atari Democrat, numbered among a group of young, tech-savvy lawmakers who champion computer technologies, like the semiconductor chips used in Atari game consoles. He's a veteran campaigner as well, the man who spearheaded Democrat George McGovern's 1972 presidential run. His own run for the White House is just getting started. The first primary in New Hampshire, still 9 months off. To build momentum in a crowded field, Hart needs money and visibility. The sponsor of the event at the Hollywood Palladium, MECLA, has plenty of cash. It will spend upwards of $300,000 in 1983 to support candidates, like Hart, who support gay rights. But Hart's support comes at a price in the form of negative publicity. A national syndicated columnist rages against the senator for daring to legitimize what has been a marginalized minority. When self-described Christian Gary Hart steps to the podium at the Hollywood Palladium on April 23rd to make common cause with a group of homosexual rights advocates and their supporters, the columnist wrote, "This will be a spectacle so bizarre that even Warner Brothers could not have envisioned it." But Hart is short on money. There are rumors that his campaign is failing to meet payroll. So he turns to Hollywood, Hollywood homosexuals no less, to boost his campaign coffers. And Hart, who has a degree in divinity from Yale, isn't about to let his political opponents smear his faith.
The criticism made against me by this columnist is that I'm not a true Christian if I attend this dinner. Let me give you my at least partial definition of what I believe Christianity, for that matter Judaism, to include. It's a love of God. It's a love, tolerance, and respect for others as for ourselves. And it includes the admonition, judge not, lest ye be judged also. Now, this attack for making this one speech suggests how difficult the daily life of every gay and lesbian American must be. If I'm attacked for one speech, you're under attack every day. It suggests that you are under constant siege from narrow-minded, judgmental zealots of the right. It suggests the forces of the right are unceasing and denying you your full rights as American citizens to make a living, secure your safety, and protect your health. It suggests something I feel very strongly, that full political and civil equality for gay and lesbian Americans has not yet been achieved, that gay and lesbian Americans are treated as second-class citizens. Democracy can only flourish when all Americans can affirm themselves as citizens by full participation in our political process.
This full-throated endorsement of gays and lesbians was something new in American politics. When 9 gay men launched MECLA 6 years earlier, in 1977, the political landscape was much different and far less welcoming for an emerging interest group with little public support and no record of success in electoral politics. Industry groups, labor unions, blacks, even women could deliver votes and dollars to friendly candidates. Gays couldn't even get politicians to take their money. In a 1983 interview with the Los Angeles Times, MECLA board member Steve Smith recalled, "Politicians were reluctant to go on the record as receiving contributions labeled gay money. We had to go around begging people to take money from us in the beginning." In 1977, America's age-old conflict between conservatives and liberals was heating up again. Conservatives had lost political ground after the Watergate scandal toppled President Richard Nixon and brought a Southern peanut farmer and Sunday school teacher, Jimmy Carter, to the White House. Republicans were eager to retake the moral high ground. Battle lines were soon drawn, and gays and lesbians were at the very center of the battle. In California, State Senator John Briggs decided that a crusade against gay teachers would energize his run for California governor. Since Democrats controlled both houses of the legislature, Briggs opted to go straight to the voters, collecting enough signatures to place Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative, on the statewide ballot in the November 1978 general election. The proposed law would have barred gays and lesbians, and even their allies, from working as teachers, classroom aides, or school counselors. MECLA, little more than a year old, jumped into the fight feet first. You're listening to This Way Out, the International LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt, continuing my look at MECLA, the Municipal Elections Committee of Los Angeles. With the battle over the Briggs Initiative, a California ballot measure that would have barred gays and lesbians from teaching in public schools, the culture wars were off to a rousing start. The campaign galvanized gays and lesbians in California and elsewhere, who rallied to the call, out of the closets and into the streets. David Mixner, one of the founders of MECLA and head of the No on Six campaign, put his political skills to work, eventually helping to line up leading conservative politicians, including former California Governor Ronald Reagan, against the Briggs Initiative. It was a brilliant strategy, casting the measure as government overreach, the nanny state on steroids. The Briggs Initiative wasn't just voted down, it was crushed, opposed by 58% of voters, losing even in conservative Orange County, California, birthplace of Richard Nixon, and a GOP stronghold since 1896. The come-from-behind victory against the Briggs Initiative put David Mixner and Mekla in a new light. Nothing succeeds like success, as they say, and America's first gay and lesbian political action committee had a success story like no other. While the gay and lesbian movement might be struggling across the country, in California, it was a force to be reckoned with. After Briggs, politicians no longer turned away Mekla's gay money. In fact, they clamored for the chance to attend the group's events and to tout their pro-gay and feminist credentials to Mekla's influential and affluent members. Mekla began holding monthly breakfast meetings at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, featuring local, state, and even national politicians. And its annual dinner drew a who's who of elected officials, mostly Democrats, eager to stand with a new brand of rich and respectable gays and lesbians. The Reverend Troy Perry, a longtime gay activist and founder of the Metropolitan Community Churches, captured the spirit of the times. "It's out of the closets and into the Beverly Wilshire," he quipped. Mekla's demands were relatively modest. Board member Peter Scott told the Los Angeles Times in 1978, "We're not asking for any special treatment. We're just asking to be allowed to express affection like any heterosexual would, without fear of losing our livelihoods." Mekla, the Times reported in 1979, does not publicly endorse candidates or lobby for legislation as its principal activity. It simply gives money to candidates who, in the group's words, are supportive of human rights in general and gay rights in particular. In March 1979, 600 gays and lesbians paid $100 a plate to mingle with California's political power structure. The dinner's sponsors included Governor Jerry Brown, Senator Alan Cranston, Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley, 9 congressmen, 20 state legislators, and 9 members of the Los Angeles City Council. Assembly Speaker Leo McCarthy, who delivered the keynote address, marveled at Mekla's growing political influence. He called Mekla a sophisticated money-giving group that is making gay activism not only politically respectable, but politically powerful as well. LA Times reporter Doyle McManus, who attended the dinner, noted that thanks to Mekla, office seekers no longer viewed gay support as the kiss of death for their campaigns. "Powerful? You bet they're powerful," one politician confided to McManus. "We pay attention, I can tell you that." What followed was Mekla's golden age. Even as the Reagan Revolution swept America, turning the country to the right, Mekla thrived. In 1981, its annual dinner raised $100,000 in a single evening. The LA Times called Mekla a network of political clout that is based on converting money and influence into political power rather than electing gays to political office. It was called checkbook activism, a clean, quiet alternative to street activism. Let gays and lesbians in San Francisco or New York chant catchy slogans under a rainbow banner. LA gays and lesbians let their money do the talking. Green was the color most politicians took notice of. Mekla offered Democrats a friendly forum to defend liberal policies that were increasingly under attack by the Republican Reagan administration, and to flip the script and attack Reagan's economic agenda.
"I view the Reagan presidency as one of the great tragedies of the 20th century."
Tom Hayden, an anti-war activist who had helped organize protests outside the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, moved inside the Democratic Party establishment in the 1970s. In 1982, he addressed Mekla as a candidate for the California Assembly, a post he would win with Mekla's help. Jerry Brown, running for the U.S. Senate after 2 terms as California's governor, received a warm welcome at a Mekla breakfast meeting at the Beverly Wilshire in the spring of 1982. Brown blasted the Reagan administration's budget cuts, which had left states like California struggling to fill gaps in social services.
"What we have is a redistribution of wealth from the very poorest people and the people who are working at the bottom of the income cycle to those at the highest income level. Now, that was supposed to produce this high level of affluence for everyone. And what it has done has not improved the economy and is tearing apart the social fabric.
Next week, I'll examine the limits of Mekla's influence and follow the organization's slow decline and demise in the midst of a global pandemic. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by John Dyer V and Ava Davis and produced by Brian DeShazer. David Hunt produced this week's feature. The Eagles, Alice Cooper, and Ite Kashi performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Steve Sims of Seattle, Washington, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on KUR, Kutztown, Pennsylvania, WPKN, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 4BI, Fortitude Valley, Queensland, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.